Hello and welcome to the Data Development Podcast from Venturi's Voice. I'm your host, Andy Davis. In this show, I'll be chatting to data experts from all sectors about their careers in tech. The show aims to bring you insights, anecdotes, and stories from like-minded professionals that you can learn from and apply to your own career. If you like the show and you want to hear more from us, you can follow us via SoundCloud, iTunes, or Spotify, or you can join us on Slack. Thank you and enjoy the show. So we've got Nicholas Gregory here, CEO of Commerce Block. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show, mate. I'm really looking forward to this. I know recently you were actually up in Manchester doing one of your Bitcoin talks. So you'll have to tell me a little bit more about it. And then I suppose after that point, I can determine whether I feel qualified or not to actually try and attend one in the future.
Sure. So there was like a conference in Manchester called CoinFest.
Right.
It's a pretty cool conference, but it's more grassroots. It's not really commercial, not, you know, no big companies there. Although we are trying to, I work for a company that's trying to be a big company, but it's kind of like old school people that have been in crypto in a while, as a very grassroots feel. So yeah, CoinFest in Manchester, it happens once a year. It was my first time, finally got an opportunity to go. It was a really good event. Lots of people from different backgrounds, all fans of Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies.
Yeah. What was your kind of taking it? I mean, I know you've obviously been interested in the space for longer than certainly the average Joe. You know, how interesting has it been to see that kind of development of interest? And do you think that, where do you think it's actually come from? Do you think that, you know, reality is that the massive spikes in stock prices has influenced people's interests? Or do you think that, you know, there is people who are genuinely interested in, like, you know, the productivity of this space?
A bit of both. Obviously, when the price goes up, it does bring new people in. But then when the price goes down, you know, some of those people leave. But I think something like CoinFest was a bit more grassroots. Like, you had a lot of people that were kind of fans of the technology. Yeah, I'd say fans of the culture. Bitcoin has got very libertarian roots. So these people tend to be a bit, I'd say, maybe a bit anarchistic, maybe anti-government, maybe the kind of guys that read Zero Hedge.
Right.
The establishment. So CoinFest definitely had that kind of feel, which but very much a cypher, what we call a cypherpunk view. You know, people that are pro-privacy, pro, you know, individual freedom, got into Bitcoin because they were a bit, you know, they were a bit not happy with the way the banks got bailed out in 2008. You know, kind of like the concept of sound money.
Yeah. Interesting. And, you know, your interests stem from where? How would you kind of say that, you know, you generated your interest? Was assuming it was relatively grassroots for you.
Yeah, I got into it around 2012. I heard about it before, but I didn't, you know, pay much attention. I guess I'm a technologist, so I was writing software for banks. Mm. So I got it through technology. But while at the same time, while working for banks, yeah, I questioned why the banks were bailed out in 2008, you know. If you run a business and it gets in trouble, the natural economics of it should be it goes bankrupt. Yeah, not many people have that luxury of the government bailing you out. And I think like a lot of people in the realms I was in was questioning that. You know, this concept of like governments, you know, being able to print money whenever they want was a bit confusing. And, you know, I guess I was just feeling this is probably not a good long-term thing. And, you know, so I was looking at some of the libertarian concepts of sound money and stuff, and Bitcoin was, for me, it was mainly fascinating around the technology, you know, this community of machines running around the world, securing. The current internet's changed many things. Like, you know, I'm from the generation, if on a Saturday night I wanted to watch a movie, it'd be the TV or Blockbuster Videos. Now it's Netflix. Mm. And Netflix basically felt like it was the Bitcoin looked like the Netflix of money. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, it's pretty good analogy, actually. And, well, I say this like I have as good of an idea as you do, but yeah, it's a fascinating concept and interesting that you kind of first got into it from a technologist perspective. Do you think that, you know, you are naturally inclined to be invested in things that drive value as a technologist, or do you think that it's more just this is like another fascinating thing? Because obviously, if I'm not mistaken, Bitcoin, you know, it kind of uses the blockchain as well. So was it kind of that technology that drew you towards it, or was it as much the purpose? Obviously, you mentioned about that you felt 2008 was, you know, a bit ridiculous, as most people did, that the banks were still surviving. But, you know, is it really about the technology and first, or does it kind of differ for you about, you know, why you get invested into a project?
It was the technology. I mean, look, I did buy Bitcoin at the beginning, but it was more to understand it. You know, it was quite hard to buy in the beginning. There weren't many exchanges. I think I bought my first Bitcoin using eBay or something silly like that. But to make an investment, no, I felt it was too risky to buy a significant amount at the time. And I still think it is quite risky. I mean, it's still very alpha technology.
Yeah,
absolutely. You know, maybe I have a bit more than what I would like in Bitcoin, but that was more because I bought it at an early stage. It is high risk. I mean, anything that's that kind of volatile is high risk.
Yeah.
But for me, yeah, it was very much the technology. I mean, I do believe in it long term. Don't get me wrong. I am bullish on Bitcoin, but then I also respect it's got high risk, exceptionally high risk.
So, you know, obviously you kind of piqued your interest when you were getting involved in it from a technical perspective. What did that kind of road from the point of interest in, you know, really trying to get up to grips and understanding Bitcoin to ultimately like what you're doing now, Commerce Block, what did that kind of trajectory look like from your kind of career perspective and that pursuit?
Yeah, I mean, so I guess when I learned Bitcoin, I mean, when I learned it, it's not something you ever learn. It's quite complex. It took me quite a while to understand it because it's not just software. There's a lot of cryptography involved. And I was never a mathematician. I was a software guy first. And once I understood it, I mean, I wanted to find ways to use it in my day-to-day job. So I was working finance, then I kind of moved into startups. And, you know, because of the regulatory environment, it was quite hard to push it in places. So through that, I ended up looking at, you know, entrepreneurial ideas. And I guess I thought, you know, obviously the first case of Bitcoin was money. But how could you peg other assets, like, you know, anything you can think of, like real estate, precious metals, equities, I mean, the ownership of your car? That's where I started to find it quite interesting. And, yeah, that's how I started to I wrote some protocols on top. Some of them were interesting. Some of them were workable. Some of them were pretty bad. And the ones that made sense, I was able to like package up into Commerce Block and essentially sell to investors and get clients interested.
Interesting. And then, you know, to the point where it is now where, you know, you're actually like you say, pursuing to try and become a big company. Was there kind of that romantic idea of like all of a sudden something clicked and then I had that aha moment and we just decided to build this thing, or was it like a bit more progressive? How did you kind of approach
it? Yeah, it was pretty more progressive. I mean, I was consulting in Bitcoin for a while, so I left banking in 2015 and I was a contractor for startups, but wherever I can I would talk about Bitcoin or do a prototype for a client. I guess it was more of an aha in terms of how the market changed. You know, I guess around 2017, there were a lot of people that didn't want to talk to me about Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies. And because I think maybe because of the price strike, the increased interest in the media, there were people that suddenly did want to talk to me. And then that was kind of, that's what, I mean, a lot of people think of the price hike. And of course, you know, I was affected by that. But it was also the bigger, I'd say the bigger people in terms of like investors and average Joes that wanted to talk to me about it, which they didn't want to talk to me about it before.
Yeah, interesting. And you know, when did you really see that kind of momentum? It doesn't seem like that long ago, really, where, you know, it really started building up some kind of mainstream attention. And then obviously,
yeah, I'd say 2017, that's when, you know, governments were talking about it. You know, HMRC, I think, released something on how to tax it. And once they want to tax you on something, I think you've made it.
That's probably true, mate. Yeah, that's a great way of looking at it. And, you know, after that, I would assume, like, trying to sell the idea felt easier, dare I say.
Yeah, very much so, yeah.
It doesn't say much. Speaking of Netflix, a couple of Netflix documentaries and all of a sudden everyone's interested and wants to buy. It's fascinating, isn't it? The cycle of these things. But I think obviously, you know, it's people, I think more and more people start to actually understand it. Although I'm very bearish on the fact that I don't think that many people still understand it. I just think people still think it's this cool, like, shiny thing, which I think it's not just the behavior of the masses. It's also particularly relevant for, like, technologists as well, because, you know, yourself, that went from working in banking and probably running teams and having to manage, you know, what we do and don't invest our time into from a technical stack perspective. There must be that same kind of battle, maybe even more so in this space that you're in now, on how to kind of determine when and where to invest time and efforts into technology within the space, because, you know, the latest and greatest isn't always the right answer.
Yeah, and there's a lot of people that come to us to say we want blockchain to do something that it wasn't really designed for, and they could probably just use a database. Right. I mean, that's the kind of, you know, a lot of the calls we have. We have to deal with a lot of issues that, like, normal companies, I think, don't deal with, like banking relationships. You know, when you say you work in cryptocurrency, it's not easy to get a bank account. You know, we probably get, you know, a lot more due diligence and stuff like that. And also, I think, you know, finding people, I mean, a lot of people are interested in, you know, Bitcoin or crypto because of the price, but it's quite a hard software environment to work in. You know, if you make a mistake, you know, Bitcoin hacks make you quite famous, yeah? So there's a lot of security things to think about, etc. as well.
Right. So is there a lot of that going on then? I don't really understand that side of it. Is there a lot of hacking involved? And
yeah, not necessarily for what we do, but for exchanges. But then we get a lot of questions around security for our clients and stuff. But yeah, it's probably going to be bigger.
Yeah, well, definitely. I would assume. I mean, it's literally it's liquid assets, isn't it, that we're dealing in here ultimately, right?
Exactly. Yeah, very much.
What's the kind of the evolution look like then with regards to that, you know, with the crypto assets, and, you know, how much has that changed? I know that was something that obviously you wrote in your notes before we came on the show, that you wanted to go into a little bit about how these crypto assets have evolved. So I'll kind of give you the floor here to hopefully kind of highlight some of the things, some of the key areas where it has evolved.
Yeah, I mean, from a client point of view, there's no shortage of clients. Where things have taken a while on the regulation side of things, but both the FCA and, you know, other jurisdictions outside of the UK have made rulings. They're starting to recognise, you know, assets on a ledger. So it's definitely moving, and we're seeing new projects all the time. People tokenizing equity, tokenizing land. That's, you know, it's happening. It's happening quite aggressively. I mean, more and more people are getting licenses, whether that's for an exchange or for the ability to tokenize certain assets. So it's definitely moving.
And, you know, as far as, like, your and how you're planning to kind of position yourselves, is it difficult to plan kind of too far ahead? Obviously, things, the way that things are evolving.
We haven't, I guess, our competitors have done it differently, and because it's not very clear. I mean, you have to be agile. I can't predict the future. I mean, I didn't predict the ICO boom of 2016. I didn't think Bitcoin would ever hit 20 grand in the next 10 years. It did, $20,000. And you can't predict what regulators are going to do. We don't really touch it with a broker-dealer license. We just focus on the software. And then we partner with other people that are in the business, like, of getting, you know, like a broker license to issue certain assets. And, you know, because we're quite small and we want to scale horizontally, where we can work with different clients from different jurisdictions, and that keeps us quite agile in that space.
Yeah.
But so, we're not driven by our clients. I mean, you know, I'd like to pick and choose what software we can write, but we don't. We're very client driven.
Is that the way you think it will? Do you think there'll ever be, like, a product or, like, a fit for purpose solution for this space?
Well, we don't really focus. I mean, our products are open source, and it's very hard to make software in this space, which is not open source because of the security nature. So where we make money is a bit on consulting, which is not where we want to be, but predominantly building services. So, for example, we have a service that's almost live called Mainstay, which basically writes state to Bitcoin blockchain. So if you wanted to store your marriage certificate, your driving certificate, you could store it on the Bitcoin blockchain in a hashed way. So it's private, but then you could prove that it existed at a point in time. We use that to secure other blockchains. We can charge like a daily, monthly, or annual fee for that. But the software is open source, so if people don't trust it, they can look at it. And that's where we, how we think we're going to evolve. And I think if you build services which other people use, which are in the blockchain space or Bitcoin space, then that's how you can grow and develop some IP and stuff like
that. Do you foresee yourself staying? Do you think that there's going to be like a next sort of evolution of where we're up to now with Bitcoin and what it actually looks like now? Do you think that when it does become perhaps more commonly used, and I'm kind of with you, I think it will happen. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there's going to be, you know, this is just obviously very speculative, but still an interesting ask, whether there is going to be like a next evolution of what we're currently looking at as what we think Bitcoin is at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say that most of the activity on Bitcoin is speculation. And probably, I mean, who knows what the percentage is of, but I think it's fair to say that its real world usage is still quite small. Whether Bitcoin's used to go to the local pub and buy a beer, I don't know. But I do think Bitcoin will be used for things like international settlement. If people need to wire a significant amount of money around the world, you can't beat Bitcoin in terms of cost and practicality. Mm-hmm. Would, you know, countries like the UK still keep the sterling, you know, currency pegged down to Bitcoin in some certain way, as opposed to go full Bitcoin? That's probably more realistic. You know, at this moment, it's hard to see that far in the future, but I don't know. But I think Bitcoin being 10 years old, it's proven itself. It's here to stay. I mean, you know, you don't need more than 3 months when it's been banned in a certain country or it's been deemed dead, and it seems to come back stronger. So I think it's fair to say Bitcoin is staying. It's going to be part of the future. How it's part of the future, I don't know. I mean, I think the usage of Bitcoin is still quite hard. Now, I would hate to get my mother to use Bitcoin. I think it's still quite, you know, nerdy. When wallets and infrastructure improves, we'll see.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's the time. Well, I think that we're not a million miles away from a cashless society, relatively speaking.
We are a cashless society. How much money do you have in your pocket? Right. I'm pretty sure you've only got plastic cards and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's true. Well, that and receipts from stuff. Yeah. That's about it. Yeah. No, I would agree with you. I think there's a generation still that like cash, but I don't see, you know, I play quite a bit of golf, and mm-hmm. there's a load of young lads, you know, teenagers and stuff. And, you know, I see them and they've all got like credit cards and stuff. And I sometimes think, bloody hell, like, you know, their parents give them the credit cards, because that was never a thing, you know, when like I was here, you'd get like a tenner or something, you know, you get your spend like that. But that, I don't think that's because they're being treated any differently than I get treated. I just think that that's the way things are now, you know, that kind of it's easier just to give them their kind of own credit card or whatever than it is to give them a tenner or whatever, or, you know, £2 or whatever it was a day for your spending money. So
we've seen how people that use Facebook all day have found out that their profiles are basically being imaged and can be used against them. The fact that, you know, these credit card companies know all our spending habits, it's not necessarily what I want to live in. It's very 1984, you know?
Yeah. Well, this is it. So it's, you know, it's cashless society is one thing, but then, you know, I suppose that's where the practicality of Bitcoin comes in, isn't it? And the blockchain effect is because it's safer, right, from my understanding, with that regard, as far as like how they can't store your data, things like that. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, you know, I think this is going to be an ongoing debate, maybe battle for future generations. I think governments are going to, you know, use the war on terrorism or other stuff to basically reduce people's privacy. And I think people are going to, you know, fight back. And I think Bitcoin is part of the fight back. People want their privacy. They don't necessarily want some sort of government agency or some sort of big company like Facebook knowing everything they do.
Yeah.
We have that battle at the moment.
Yeah. Well, it's a very visible battle as well, and I suppose rightly so. Definitely the anarchist underground Bitcoin coming out in you there, by the way.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm part of the establishment. I worked for a bank, but I was a fan of the movie Fight Club and The Matrix, and you see what's going on in the world where there's not much we can do. And even if you're not a conspiracy theorist, which I'm not, all it takes is a hack in Facebook, and we've seen people's personal details being stolen, and people are marked for life.
Yeah.
We've seen it. There's always a hack going on. Imagine if, you know, Facebook or Twitter lose all their data, or LinkedIn have all their data. You know, your privacy's wrecked.
Yeah.
I think there's safety concerns that we're creating these honeypots of information, which could be very damaging to people.
No.
And that's forgetting about the conspiracy theories. I mean, if you know, I'm not a tinfoil hat guy, but even just pure accidents happen. You know, software's made by humans. Software's going to get hacked. It's going to be data breaches in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this is it. And this is why there's so much... correct me if I'm wrong, but like the initial concept of the internet was quite libertarian and built on decentralization.
I've got a friend who always jokes about that. He said in the early days of the internet, it was very pioneered by libertarians and that it was about freedom of information, and it ended up becoming the world's best surveillance system.
Yeah, yeah.
And is Bitcoin the same thing? Is Bitcoin going to be this libertarian thing of, you know, an attack against cashless society? Right? Is Bitcoin going to be a huge surveillance system? We don't know. I mean, that's why, you know, Bitcoin transactions are public on a public blockchain. And obviously, there's moves in Bitcoin to make it more private. Our government's going to say, well, if your Bitcoin transactions are private, they can't be used at the local pub and stuff like that. That's interesting. We don't know. I don't know. I think... at the moment, Bitcoin's small enough where governments don't really care about it. But if it becomes big, that's curious. I'm curious what's going to happen there.
Yeah. The the actual company that obviously you're involved in and you're building now, and we always like to try and talk a little bit about the kind of the people side of things as well. I can't imagine that like hiring is, you know, as far as selling people on working for, what the cultural side of things and working for, a business that's working on something as compelling than this is particularly difficult. On the contrary, it's probably extremely difficult to find people who've kind of got a good skill set as well. So how have you kind of found to this point, like developing and building out a team and a culture that, you know, is kind of you're united?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of our guys come from academia. I mean, one of the things of crypto, you know, it is about cryptography. So, we've had to take people from we've approached universities and stuff like that to take people that have, you know, maybe been working in academia, doing research work in maths. That's where we've had to work. But yeah, hiring, it's not been easy. I mean, especially we're based in London. We compete with the banks in terms of what we're doing, and also, you know, the banks have got much bigger budgets in terms of hiring as well. And so our guys arguably leave us and go join a bank and have their salary potentially doubled. So, you know, what we sell is that, you know, we're building Netflix. We say that banks are building Blockbuster Video. We try and create a more, you know, relaxed culture, you know, let people work from home, you know, trying to make it. Most of the work we do actually is open source. So even if Commerce Block is not successful, people's commits, the work they've done is public. It stays with them, as opposed to people who may have worked for a bank for 5 years. When they leave, they have nothing really to show for it.
Yeah, I suppose so. Do you find as well that the momentum that some of the fintechs are having is actually helping with that regard as well?
It is, and also the environment is helping. Like a couple of our guys, they live out in the countryside. They don't necessarily want to commute an hour and a half a day. People are tired of London. You know, we let people, you know, once we trust people, you know, we try and create an environment where people can work from home more. And I think that's going to probably grow. I mean, you know, London can't get bigger. We can't build more buildings. The transport system, you know, it's reached maximum capacity, and having a flexible work environment where people can work from home a lot, I think that's another space outside of crypto which is going to have to grow. I mean, you know, it's kind of very inefficient how much people spend commuting. I mean, look at me and you. We're doing this podcast. We didn't have to meet each other. You know, you're in Manchester, I'm in London. Why can't people work more and more like that? And I think as the tooling in that space improves, I think that's going to be a bigger thing. how do you build a global company without necessarily having one big office somewhere, one big skyscraper somewhere? And I think that fits very much into crypto. I mean, I've worked with people in the Bitcoin space for 6 years. I can tell you there's some people I know really well I've never met. You know, like there's some guys in Thailand, you know, Europeans that relocated there that set up software shops for crypto that I've been speaking for 4 years every day. I know the names of their kids, but I've never physically met them. And that's one of the, you know, maybe I'm going off on a bit of a tangent, but I think that's where we're leading to at the moment as well.
Yeah, well, why not? I mean, like, I've never understood why, especially in this country, it's not actually that big of a place. Why London's so built up in this one area when it takes an hour and a half to get from where I am to London.
Well, it's ridiculous. And, you know, we keep on touching, you know, people, we spend so much time moving people around. Maybe we just need to move the jobs around with the internet, you know, much more efficient.
Yeah, yeah. Well, exactly. I don't know. It's bizarre. I think there's some things that can be said for like a face-to-face environment, I think, depending on obviously what the line of work is. But yeah, there's certainly, we're still probably underutilizing the internet from that perspective.
I mean, I'm a Londoner, obviously. But, you know, the city I grew up in has doubled in size, but, you know, the tube hasn't necessarily doubled in size. So, you know, it's become a harder place for me to live in. It's become twice as expensive to live in, probably 10 times expensive. I would actually like to live in the countryside now where I don't spend my life on the tube. But, you know, it's very hard to run a business that way. But then I say that the first 2 years of CommerceBlock, I worked out of my bedroom. My business partner originally was in Israel. Another guy I knew was in New York. I want the company to scale that way. But I think the technology needs to improve, and not the internet, but, you know, the tooling to do remote working. But that's something we spend a lot of time with on the side.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess it makes sense because it's aligned with the line of work that you're in anyway, doesn't
it? So, yeah. But no, I'm a big fan of that. And yeah, there's a lot of smart people that I work with that don't want to be in a noisy environment, don't want to waste their life in public transport. And I think Bitcoin, I can't tell you how much Bitcoin resonates to those kind of people. As I said, I know people around the world in crypto. So many, I know them on, you know, I know the names of their kids, their wives. I've never met them. But I'd consider them good friends because of the way Bitcoin kind of groups people from different backgrounds, different ideologies, different cultures together without needing to move us around the world, without having to put a hole in the ozone to fly people around or relocate people, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I said once, and it, you know, maybe it upset a few people, that Bitcoin is too true globalization. It's a global currency that people around the world from different ideologies, different backgrounds work together on and work well without having to like change. Yeah, I wrote this article once. You know, Bitcoin is an example of globalization the way it should be working, not a political ideology, and kind of got some nasty emails off that, but I think you're getting what I mean by that. Yeah,
no, I totally get it, but I think that, you know, the pro, it's a pro and a con of Bitcoin, I think, is that the fact that there is that, I think that there is that political element and libertarianism that kind of comes along with it. But there always was that, like, say, with the internet as well. So yeah, it's a good comparison that it's there. But I think it's an element of frustration that seems to have to go hand in hand with it. And the press that it's built up in the past as well with, you know, Silk Road and things like that. It just didn't help its cause for me, and that's always a barrier to entry for anything like that.
There's parallels with the internet, because I don't know how old you are, but you don't have to tell me, but in the early days of the internet was just a place for porn and drugs.
Yeah.
And that's how it was, you know, that's how it was portrayed. And now like most people do, spend a lot of time buying stuff on Amazon. It's grown from that. And I think it's normally the illicit industries that pioneer technology.
Yeah, it's interesting. My degree is economics, right? So it's so predictable with what history tells us on the way that humans behave. It's very predictable, actually. Especially, I mean, I studied in the US, so US economy is incredibly predictable with its peaks and troughs. You know, it's almost perfectly aligned every 20 years to have a peak and a trough.
Yeah.
And this is reminds me of that exact way with how, you know, something like decentralization, we behave the exact same way. You know, it's the reluctance, then there's more, the momentum build, then it almost becomes centralized again, you know. And I just wonder whether, you know, because humans are just creatures of habit, that we'll do the exact same thing time and time again. So I think that's what kind of gives me optimism that this will arise, but then also whether we will or won't be around for it, you'll inevitably see similar patterns happen to what's happened with the internet, with the
becoming
centralized. So I think that that's, for me, it's relatively predictable. And the, you know, everything that I mentioned, yeah, it happened before, and that's what's exactly what's happening now. That's where the reluctance comes from, and that's what people try to cast it as, is to make it us and them. And then people see the practical elements, get involved, and then it'll merge. And I just, you know, I'm tempted to believe that it's predictable that it will, that will be the case. It's just, I think for me, the only thing that seems to be, shifting is the rate of change, and the speed of things seems to be an increasing rate. What maybe was a 20-year peak and trough might be a 15 or a 10-year now.
And also, I mean, I don't know. I mean, governments tried to regulate the internet, but they kind of didn't. But then the internet kind of became fairly centralized and regulated. I don't know if governments can keep up with Bitcoin. I mean, very oppressive governments like China and Russia tried to ban it, but the rate of progress on the technology kind of was too quick. And have we reached a point where technology is going to outpace the regulator, it's going to outpace governments? That's what I'm interested in. That's what I think it's going to be. Yeah. I don't know the answer, but that's why I think it's going to be quite interesting, because technology is starting to outpace most people, you know?
Yeah.
Bitcoin's got an army of developers. You know, crypto's got an army of developers that really, you can't stop people writing software.
Yeah. No, well, you can't. I mean, it's outpacing ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, the same. It's outpacing the people who are writing it, right? I mean, that's ultimately what's happening. So, yeah, there's no way that we can kind of keep up with that moment. I mean, you're seeing all the institutional commodities that aren't able to keep up. Look at schools, you know, look at universities. What's the point in that now? Going 4 years. To try and learn software development. Whatever you learn in year one will be redundant by year two, never mind year four or year three or whatever.
And with open source technology, and, you know, I mean, I know some guys who contributed at Bitcoin at 18, and some of the smartest people I know, they did university just to get that, you know, that label. But what they learned about software development was by, you know, contributing to open source projects. That's where they got their, you know, their graft and stuff.
I think that's been most jobs, you know, perhaps, you know, I don't know, lawyers and doctors are about the only people I think who actually learn what they need to learn. And even they probably learn more actually on the job practically.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, everything seems to be kind of outgrowing, but there's no kind of major disruption in those kind of institutionalized areas yet. Mm-hmm. But it will have to change to keep up. I mean, you know, the Americans certainly invest heavily in it, don't they? As we found out with the whistleblowing saga and stuff with the NSA and stuff. But yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what happens. Like I say, I think this is what makes it so fascinating. As humans, we're always intrigued by the unknown, aren't we? And this is certainly one of that falls into that category.
Absolutely.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Nicholas. Thanks for spending the time with us and chatting. It's very difficult to have a conversation like this and try and cram it into around 30 minutes. So thanks for kind of doing your best effort. I certainly tried to keep up, so appreciate the time, mate.
Yeah, thanks for your time. Enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the show. I look forward to hearing everyone's thoughts on this episode over on the Venturers Voice Slack group. See you next time. Thank you.